So let me begin for the whole weekend by telling you what I mean by this idea of preach the bloody gospel or the bloody Bible. There are difficult accounts in the Bible. They strain our beliefs. I'm going to be honest about that, and I think we all ought to be. There are some stories that we read and we wonder, man, that just sounds either harsh or hard to believe or difficult for me to reconcile with the God that I know. Sometimes they seem so brutal. They seem so capricious. God, in some cases, seems to be really hard and quick to respond to circumstances with people. And in fact, some of those stories almost seem contrary to the God we know. The more we look at it as adults, the more we become uneasy with the stories as they are given to us. And so there are account detractors and there are unbelievers who bring that up to disprove the veracity of the Bible. There are people who will say, oh, okay, so you believe in God, you believe God's love. Well, explain this to me. Well, why did God do this? Or how about this story? How can you reconcile this with your God? And I was looking at a website along these lines with a person who had his 10 objections to the Bible. And what he concluded after his 10 objections at the end was, so all you preachers out there who believe the Bible is the inspired word of a God that you claim to follow, why don't you guys preach the bloody Bible? And the point he was making was, why don't y'all talk about the difficult things? Not just John 3:16, God so loved the world, or not just the passages that talk about how we're known by the love we have for one another. What about the tough passages? What about the difficult stories? And you may be asking, well, why do we need to examine those? That's the problem with those other people out there. But I do think we need to examine these stories. And I'll give you two reasons why. First, because these are the concerns of our culture. These are things that people that you know are bothered by. And it used to not be that case. It used to be when I first started preaching, way back, when 2 years before baseball, I think it was. When I first started preaching, the kinds of things that you dealt with in trying to answer the objections of non-believers or those who were doubters were proving the resurrection. You know, that Jesus was truly raised from the dead. Or explaining the unity of the Bible. How could all these books be from God when they're so disparate in their approaches and in their focus? Or the is it true questions. You know, is it true that Jesus did this or that this was what the Bible really said? It was things like, so you really think Jonah was swallowed by a whale? I mean, is that really true? Those are the kinds of things that I dealt with when I first started looking at apologetics. But increasingly, the current concerns are more about ethical issues. They're about the consistency of God to act according to his own rules. The apparent differences between the God of the Old Testament and the God of the New Testament. Is this the same God? I mean, the same God that tells us to love one another is the same God who told the Israelites slaughter their enemies and kill not only men, but women and children and animals? Is that the same God? So those are the questions that are being asked. And I think we need to answer those. I think we have an obligation to at least understand those things ourselves and come up with what we think are reasonable answers to keep us consistent in the Word of God. But secondly, because we've not always read these accounts carefully. I'm going to tell you, I haven't. I grew up in a church setting. I grew up going to Bible class. And when I was growing up, they didn't have all the AV equipment that they have today. What we had were stick figures drawn on a board or the famous Betty Lukens flannel graph series. And the teachers would go up and they'd tell a story and they would put on a piece of flannel, they'd put these pictures. Here's Jesus, and here's the leper that he healed. And they'd put them up, and they'd tell those stories. And I came away from some of those stories with an impression that later, as an adult, I went back and looked at more carefully, and I thought, I got that wrong. I didn't get that story right. So I think we need to look at these things that may not be accurate, because we've picked up pieces here and there at the risk of having some of you go on your phones while I'm preaching, which I don't want you to do. There's a video that I heard about not too long ago, and it's called Scary Mary. And what it consists of is a series of snippets from the Mary Poppins 1964 Disney movie. But the person who put this together put together really narrow clips, just little pieces of that whole movie, and then put one of the songs that's a kind of a background song in this, that is one of the minor tone songs that Mary Poppins sings about going to sleep and going to bed. And she's singing this to the kids, close your eyes now, go to sleep. And that's playing in the background while you see all these pictures of Mary and its stark looks, or its stern looks, or it's her floating in the fog. And you see that in that setting and you say, ooh, that's a scary movie. That's a horror movie. Because it looks that way. And I think sometimes we've taken some stories from the Bible, and we've taken a clip here and a clip here, and something else is said over here, and we've drawn conclusions about God that aren't really fair. Now, you might be saying tonight, look, Ralph, I don't need to study all those things. I believe the Bible. Whatever the Bible says, that's what I believe. And if I can't reconcile it, then I just accept it. And I'm saying that's okay for you. But that doesn't answer the questions for other people. If your neighbors read the book of Genesis and comes away with a really ugly impression of the God who turned Lot's wife into a pillar of salt, just because she turned around and looked at something, you can't convince your neighbor that they've got a wrong impression of God just by saying, well, I believe the Bible and I believe the God I know, and that's good enough for me. I don't think you can do that. It's okay to wrestle with the text. It's all right. It's okay for us to get in it deep and say, there's got to be a deeper answer than the surface one of just, I believe it. God said it, I believe it, and that's all that matters. Because I think God gave us the Bible so that we would study it and examine it and think about it and wrestle with it as we move through it. So sometimes I agree, we have to just trust God the same way we just trust other experts. You know, you go into a doctor and the doctor looks you over and the doctor says, oh, I'm going to have to take this scalpel and I'm going to have to cut this thing on the side of your face. I got to cut into you to get this cyst out, because it's a kind of a dangerous thing and it could get infected. And I need to cut that out. And you will let a doctor do that. Not because, oh yes, I knew it was a cyst. I knew it was dangerous. That's why I came to you. I want you to do that. You'll trust it. But if I walked up to you with my pocket knife and just said, hey, that thing on the side of your cheek looks kind of ugly, let me go at it, you go, I'm not trust you with that. I don't even know you. So it's okay sometimes to ultimately come down to, he's God, he does what's right, and I'm just going to have to live with that. But I don't think that's the bottom line for every one of the stories that we read in the Bible. So let me give you two quotes before we start tonight's lesson. Let me give you two quotes that I think illustrate the kind of person I'm trying to address. I don't think it's you. I don't think you're the skeptic. Though I think we have some problems with some of the stories when we're honest. And I hope this will help you. But here's the kind of person that this series was designed to address. You know Winnie the Pooh. Winnie the Pooh didn't say this, but the writer of Winnie the Pooh did. A.A. Milne made this statement. The Old Testament is responsible for more atheism, more agnosticism, and more disbelief than any other book ever written. Some of you may know a very popular magician in Las Vegas who's part of a team. Penn Jillette is part of a team called Penn and Teller. Penn Jillette has a website and he has YouTube videos and he has over 2 million followers. He's not only a renowned magician, but he is a very staunch atheist. Militant atheist. And here's what he said. I read the Bible cover to cover. If you read it, I believe you will emerge from that as an atheist. So let's look at some of the bloody aspects of the Bible. And tonight we're going to look at the first of those together. Tomorrow we'll look at some others, and Lord willing, Sunday we'll look at the other, so that by the time we're done, we'll have looked at 6 different stumbling blocks for atheists, agnostics, and disbelievers. And maybe some stumbling blocks that you have. Here's a statement. The Bible speaks of the ark leveling mountains and laying waste to entire regions. An army which carries the ark before it is invincible. That statement was made by Marcus Brody in the famous movie Raiders of the Lost Ark. Now, it's a pretty cool statement. And it's made when Brody's looking at that picture of the ark and it's glowing and the armies are falling before it. It's a great movie copy, but it's lousy Bible study. The Bible doesn't say that. But there is one story about the ark that causes difficulties for a lot of us. And I want to deal with that one tonight as we look at Uzzah and the ark. It's one of the stories Betty Lukens showed me when I was a child in the flannel graph lessons. In order for us to really get to the end of the story, we've got to start at the beginning, because this whole story is a building process. So the story begins in, it ends in 2 Samuel chapter 6, but it begins in 1 Samuel chapter 4. Now, you're welcome to go back in your Bibles and look at this as I go through it. I want to kind of relate the story to you, but you'll be able to see it, and I'll pick up the passages along the way that will help you stay current with it, so you'll know that I'm being accurate with the scriptures here. And we're ultimately going to end up in 2 Samuel chapter 6 and look at Uzzah himself. In 1 Samuel chapter 4, the Israelites are going to war against the Philistines. Surprise. They're always going to war with the Philistines. But in this particular case, at the battleground called Aphek, the Philistines kill 4,000 Israelites. And the Israelites flee the battlefield. Philistines are cheering. They're playing Another One Bites the Dust. And the Israelites are running. They're taking off. And the Israelites go back and huddle up. And they say, you know why we lost? Because we didn't listen to Marcus Brody in Raiders of the Lost Ark. If we can get the Ark of the Covenant, and when I say Ark in this lesson, I'm not talking about the big boat Noah built. I'm talking about the small box that Israel built in the wilderness at God's direction and according to his pattern. And it was a box that contained Aaron's rod, and it contained a jar of manna, and it contained a copy of the Ten Commandments. And it had the cherubim over the top of it that were the mercy seat, and it stayed in the tabernacle, which was the tent where God would meet with his people. That ark was a symbol of God's presence. And so the Israelites figured, if we can take that into battle, we'll beat the Philistines. It's like a talisman or a good luck charm for us. Now, if you go back, and I do want you to look at one passage real quick. In Numbers chapter 10, when the ark is constructed and the Israelites set out from their camp, and I'm showing you this because I think this is what the Israelite soldiers were thinking about when they came up with this plan. Marcus is wrong when he says any army that carried this into battle was invincible. Because first of all, Israel didn't carry it into battle. Not as a rule. That thing didn't go out with them. It wasn't some kind of war talisman for them. They do that here, but that's not their practice. But the Israelites, so where did they get this idea that maybe the ark might help them? Well, if you look, when the cloud of fire by night or a cloud or the pillar of cloud by day set out and Israel all went through the wilderness marching, it says in verse 35 of chapter 10, it came about when the ark set out that Moses said, "Rise up, O Lord, and let your enemies be scattered. Let those who hate you flee before you." And then when it came to rest, when they stopped and they set up camp, he said, "Return, O Lord, to the myriad thousands of Israel." So the idea was, I'm going to point to this just as an example of what that might have looked like. When they got ready to march and God's pillar of cloud by day or fire by night went ahead of them, they would pick up the ark. They had rods that went down the side of it and rings on the sides, and they would put these staves through that, and the priests would carry it on their shoulders, four of them, one on each side because it was very heavy. It wasn't this. Wasn't like this carry. It was one over here, one over there, ready, all of us lift together. And that ark would go before them. And when it went out, Moses, or whoever was leading Israel at that time, would say, "Let your enemies be scattered, God. Here we come. We're going through the wilderness. Move the enemies out of the way. And those who oppose you, may they be wiped out." So now Israel's lost 4,000 soldiers in this pitched battle against the Philistines. They go back and say, "Man, what happened? Who called that play? And that didn't work at all." And so they say, hey, let's get the ark." Probably remembering this, the enemies will be what? Scattered. They'll be routed. So let's take the ark into battle with us. And that's what they do. They go get the ark, and here they come to face the Philistines. And as it's coming, and there's this big cry in the camp of Israel, you know, they're all chanting, "Here we come, get out of our way." And the Philistines say, oh no, they brought the ark. They did listen to Marcus Brody. They had seen the movie and they thought the ark was really going to be a bad thing for them. So they trembled. They said, "Oh no, they brought God." They said it. They had brought God into their camp. But then I'm going to tell you something about the Philistines. It's pretty heroic because When they realize that that's what's happening, I want to read the words for you in 1 Samuel chapter 6. chapter 4, excuse me. When the Philistines, verse 6, heard the noise of the shout, they said, what is the noise of this great shout in the camp of the Hebrews mean? And they understood the ark of the Lord had come. And they said, God has come into the camp. And they understood that the ark of the Lord had come. Woe to us! Nothing like this has happened before. Woe to us! Who shall deliver us from the hand of these mighty gods? These are the gods who smote the Egyptians with all kinds of plagues in the wilderness. Here's what is impressive about the Philistines. Rather than saying, run! What they say is, take courage. Be men, O Philistines, or you will become slaves to the Hebrews as they've been slaves to you. Therefore, be men and fight. I'm going to tell you something. If you're going to go to war, that's the guys you want. Fight to the death. We'll go down, but we're not going to be slaves to these Israelites. We'll fight. So, they do. And they win. The Israelites are slaughtered. They kill 30,000 Israelite soldiers. 30,000. I mean, listen, that's more than half of the military losses America suffered in the Vietnam War. This is one battle. 30,000 men died of the Israelite army. And two more things happened. Three things. 30,000 men died. The ark was captured. The Israelites drop it and run. And the high priest's two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, who went carrying the ark into battle, they're both killed. They're killed in battle. And their dad, Eli, is back at home. And when the news is brought, we're destroyed. We've lost 30,000 men. Hophni and Phinehas are dead. Eli takes that news. But when they said, and the ark has been captured, it says Eli fell backwards off his seat and broke his neck and died. And he had a daughter-in-law who was married to Hophni, and she was pregnant. And when she heard about this, she immediately went into labor and died giving birth to her son. And her last words were, name him Ichabod. The only Ichabod most of us know is Ichabod Crane from another Disney film. Or the legend, the headless horseman. But Ichabod has a name that means something. His name means the glory has departed from Israel. What glory? That they lost 30,000 men? No. That they lost Hophni and Phinehas? No. That they lost this. The Philistines have the ark. So now what happens with that in chapter 5, is for 7 months, the Philistines have the ark. And I think I could probably summarize what happens. The Philistines have five major cities way down on the southwest corner of Israel on the coast. Five cities. And for 7 months, they play hot potato with the ark. Because wherever the ark goes, trouble follows. They first set it up. They take it and they put it in the temple of Dagon, their god. They put it in there as a spoil of war. hey, Dagon, we're bringing you something. This is the God we beat for you today. And they put it there, and there's a series of things that happen. They're not real important to us, but Dagon is found face down, and they set him back up the next day, and the ark is still there. And the next time they come, not only is he face down, but his arms are broken off. And then they find out, oh man, bad things are happening. They are afflicted with tumors. I mean, rampant tumors in all the Philistines. And mice invade their fields, and they cause famine for them. So they've got pestilence and pests, and they've got this horrible tumor issue that's in their bodies. And all of this is because of that ark. So the first city that had it says, we don't want this thing. Now, what do you do with it? Let's send it to one of our other cities. So they send it from that city to Ekron. And the people at Ekron go, wonder why the people of Ashdod sent us this. You're about to find out. This is going to get really bad for y'all. Hey, we got the ark. And the people of Ashdod are going, man, we're getting rid of tumors and mice. And all the mice are going, everybody to Ekron, you know? And so they're eating up all the fields there. And it's a little while before the Ekronites realize that's the cause of all this. The stinking people at Ashdod sent us this thing, and it's a curse. So what do the people of Ekron do? Put that thing on a UPS truck and send it to Gath. So Amazon delivers to Gath. There's the ark. And the people of Gath say, woohoo, we'll take it. Put it on display. And then all of a sudden, tumors, mice, pestilence. So it goes from city to city to city for those 7 months. And finally, the Philistines say, yeah, we've got to get rid of this thing. I mean, we need to send it back because it ain't working. There is no joy in the cities of the Philistines as long as this thing's here. So they come up with a plan. And this plan is important for our story at the end. They put it on a new ox cart. They build a cart for it. And they set it on the ox cart. And then they take 2 milking cows. Cows that have been feeding their calves. This is important. It's all part of what the Philistines thought was important. So they hook the 2 cows up to the cart. And just for the sake of illustration, Israel is that way. Sending it back to Shiloh, or to at least the southernmost city of Israel, is right through those doors. They take the calves, let the milk cows see their babies, and they take the calves and send them in the sight of the cows, send them to the cities of Philistia. Okay, you're a mama cow. What's your inclination? Go with the babies, right? So if the cows go with the babies, we're wrong in what we assume is the problem. But if the cows do something kind of miraculous and ignore their babies and go to Israel instead, then we're doing the right thing. And our gods and their God is telling us, yep, that's the right thing to do. And you know what those cows do? Straight to Israel. I mean straight. Don't meander at all. They don't stop and chew cud. They go straight to Israel with that ox cart. And they added something. They put a box of gifts for the Israelites. You know, it wasn't a box of pears from Harry and David's or anything like that. What they put in that box were 5 carved gold mice. And you can understand that. The one that's a little harder to understand is five carved tumors. And I don't know if they guessed or they had volunteers that say, cut one out of me and make one like that. I don't know. But they put the tumors and the mice in a box and put it on the ox cart and sent it to Israel. It was their way of saying, we surrender. Not we'll be your slaves, but we surrender in this situation. Please take your ark back. We're done with the tumors and we're done with the mice. So it's taken back. And the Israelites see the ox cart coming with the two cows lowing. And they make a straight path for Beth Shemesh. That's a city in Israel. So the Israelites leave it there. They say, don't leave it right there on the cart. And they send for the Levites. Levites, come take this thing down. And then they offer a bunch of sacrifices around the ark. And there was a great celebration, but some of the Israelites went up to that ark and they said, we got a chance to look in this thing. And they did. They lifted the lid on the ark and looked in it. And God slaughtered the citizens of Beth Shemesh for looking in the ark. Now, it probably didn't happen like it does in Raiders of the Lost Ark when the Nazis open. I don't think it's a bunch of ghoulish figures coming out and blowing their heads off. But God does kill the citizens who treated the ark with disrespect and looked inside it. So the people asked the city of Kiriath Jearim, will you take that ark? They probably have heard this thing causes tumors and mice. And they certainly are picking up the bodies of their fellow citizens at Beth Shemesh and are saying, this thing's dangerous. We need to take it and put it someplace else. So they say to the citizens of Kiriath Jearim, will you take it for yourselves? And they say yes, and they house it. They build a shelter over the top of the ark. And Eleazar, who is the son of Abinadab, was appointed to watch over it. So you got one Israelite whose duty every day is to go punch in the clock and go sit and watch the ark every day. It's his job. Just watch the ark. For what reason? Well, it's not going anywhere. Make sure nobody else touches it. Make sure nobody steals it. Make sure nobody else can get hurt by it. He is appointed to do that for 20 years. For 20 years, that ark stays there under that shelter. Every day, Eleazar checking in. For 20 years. Probably didn't get a pay raise. But he's got a job that's important for the Israelites. Samuel comes and anoints Saul, king of Israel. The ark is still there. The ark stays throughout the reign of Saul, 40 years, stays there. And then David comes. And now, listen, let me tell you where you got to go. You have to go all the way to 2 Samuel. Now, 2 Samuel chapter 6. This is the history we've gone through. That may not look like much in your Bible right there, but that's almost 100 years of work the Israelites are doing right there. And now David's king, and David says, I am going to make Jerusalem my capital city, and I want the ark there. Now think about it. That ark's not been moved since the Philistines brought it back and the priest took it off the cart, burned that ox cart as a sacrifice along with animals, and left the ark there. It has not been touched by anybody in that length of time. So, now, with that said, look at the story in 2 Samuel chapter 6. David arose, verse 2. He went with all the people who were with him to Baal Judah to bring up from there the ark of God, which is called by the name, the very name of the Lord of hosts, who is enthroned above the cherubim. They placed the ark of God on a new cart that they might bring it from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill. And Uzzah and Ahio, the sons of Abinadab, were leading the new cart. So they brought it with the ark of God from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill, and Ahio was walking ahead of the ark. Meanwhile, David and all the house of Israel were celebrating before the Lord with all kinds of instruments made of fir wood, lyres, harps, tambourines, castanets, cymbals. When they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzzah reached out toward the ark of God and took hold of it, for the oxen nearly upset it. And the anger of the Lord burned against Uzzah, and God struck him down there for his irreverence. And he died there by the ark of God. This is the story, the kind of story that led Penn Jillette to say, I don't want a God like that. I mean, he just moved it. It was falling. He just stopped it from falling, and God struck him dead on the spot. What kind of God is this? And I want to suggest a couple of things to you. First of all, where do you think they got the idea of putting it on a new cart? They got it from the Philistines. I mean, it's exactly the same terminology. And you might not have seen that before because you're back there reading 1 Samuel and then well into 2 Samuel. You hear it again, but you may not have made the connection, but that's a direct connection. New cart. That's what the Philistines did. Is that the way God told them to carry it? God never told them to put it on a cart. It was to be put on the shoulders of the priests. It's the only way it was to be carried. If you put those staves through the rings on both sides and you put priests on all four ends, that cart's not going anywhere. I mean, that ark isn't going anywhere. It's not going to fall. I mean, even if one priest stumbled in a hole or something, the other three are going to keep that erect. It was never to be placed on a cart like that. They're doing, they didn't even get it from God's people. They got it from the stinking Philistines who don't even honor God. Secondly, Uzzah isn't acting with knee-jerk reflexes. Read carefully. It says he reached out and touched the ark. When I was a boy, I really thought, and maybe teachers led me to think this, or maybe it was just my imagination, but I thought, you know, that the cart's going along, the oxen are walking, and it's hitting potholes, and they don't have pneumatic tires, you know. They've got wooden tires or metal, and it's hard and rocking. And the ark is sitting on that new cart, and it's bouncing around. And I thought, oh, here it goes. It's starting to fall to the side, and Uzzah just kind of reaches up to stop it from falling on him. He just stopped. And as soon as he touched it, bam, he's killed, just like that. And I thought, Man, you get killed for a reflex action? But that's not the way the story reads. It's much more likely. Where did it say his partner was? Ahio is in front. And David and all the others are in front. It says where they are. So where is Uzzah? He's not out in front because he's not mentioned there. He's walking along beside it. Or maybe behind it. And he sees, oh, that thing's starting to get on the edge. It's starting to rock. It's moving toward the edge. And he just walks up and consciously, deliberately readjusts it. He touches it. Knowingly touches it. Now, David gets angry. When Uzzah's killed, David says, drop the ark right there. Don't move it. It says David became angry because of the Lord's outburst against Uzzah. But David isn't angry at God. He's afraid of God. Verse 9, he was afraid of the Lord that day. And he said, how can the ark of the Lord come to me? He's puzzled now. He thought he could move it. He's not moving it the right way. He's not moving it the way God said move it. Uzzah's now dead because David was careless, as were all the people, as were the priests. They're careless about dealing with a thing that represents God. Remember, that's what the Philistine said. God has come to this battle. If a person wanted to show terrible disrespect to God, and they were outside this building, and they came in here, and they wanted to show how much they despise God, what would they probably attack? Our Bibles. Probably take a Bible and throw it on the ground, put lighter fluid on it, and set it on fire, or rip the pages out. Here's what I think of your God. And we would be offended by that. I mean, I don't think we'd attack them or beat them up or kill them with that, because we got other Bibles. We'd say, well, you can have that one. We got 100 more back here. But the representation of God is that ark. It is God's presence. And they are treating it carelessly. They're not treating it the way God said treat. And so a man is dead now because of that. That thing sits for 3 months on the property of Obed-Edom. They just leave it there. And then what's really interesting, the story goes on. Obed-Edom is blessed tremendously because the ark's on his property. All his crops are going nuts and all of his animals are giving birth to twins and triplets. And he can't get enough good things. And David hears about that and he says, go get that ark. Good things happen when you treat it right. And so in 1 Chronicles chapter 15, I know I'm going to take you one more time and we're done, okay? We're done with passages. If you go to 1 Chronicles chapter 15, it says in verse 11, David called for Zadok and Abiathar, the priests, and for the Levites, for Uriel, Asaiah, Joel, Shemaiah, Eliel, and Aminadab. And he said to them, you're the heads of the fathers' households of the Levites. Consecrate yourselves, you and your relatives, that you may bring up the ark of the Lord, of the God of Israel, to the place I prepared for it. Because you did not carry it at the first, the Lord our God made an outburst on us, for we did not seek him according to the ordinance. So they consecrated themselves. And verse 15 says, the sons of the Levites carried the ark of God on their shoulders with the poles thereon, as Moses had commanded them according to the word of the Lord. So now they did it right. And how many people died when they did that? Zero. No deaths. it's delivered safely. And they put up on the safety record, deaths this day, zero. Nobody died. Why? Because they did it right. They did it the way God said do it. So, conclusion. Let me give you three things I think we need to learn from this story. Number one, the priests failed the people. The priests should have been the ones. They knew the law. They knew what was right. They failed the people. They should have taught them proper ark maintenance. They should have told them that. And they should have taught them the purpose of the ark was not a war talisman. They didn't do that. When we don't teach future generations the word of God, problems happen. Second, the people followed false conclusions. They did the Philistine thing. Look, I can almost guarantee you it doesn't matter what course of action you take. Follow people who are doing it wrong and you will do it wrong. I don't want to take any cues from people in religious groups that aren't following the word of God clearly and careful. You're just begging for an Uzzah incident. When you do that, be very careful about that. The Philistines had zeal, but not according to knowledge. They didn't have a true knowledge. Now, they didn't get hurt for what they did there, but boy, there were a lot of them said, oh, we got hurt. Well, I mean, man, we had tumors. And we had mice like you wouldn't believe. Don't follow false practices. And third conclusion, Uzzah died because of everyone else's carelessness. He didn't die just because of what he did. Not just because of what he did. He died because everybody was careless. What if the priests, what if the people, and what if Uzzah had done right? Everybody had been alive. We wouldn't have this story. And we wouldn't have ever had to wrestle with it. But people who wrestle with this story aren't understanding the kinds of details we just talked about tonight. If we are careful to do God's will, God's way, we don't have Uzzah incidents. God struck Uzzah for, it says, his irreverence. Wasn't treating God as holy. Wasn't treating him the way he should. And so, somebody died. And a host of people today point to that story and say, I'll never believe in that God. I'll never follow that God without realizing that God wasn't at fault. It was the priests and the people and Uzzah being the wrong man in the wrong place at the wrong time. It didn't have to happen, and it doesn't have to happen to us. God doesn't want your death, and he doesn't want to send any of us to hell. He's made all kinds of provisions for that not to happen. And so I would say to you, don't fear this God. Honor him. Appreciate him for what he has done and what he's given to us by way of instructions as to how to follow him. And if this evening you've had a problem with this God and you want to talk about it more, we can talk about it. We'll talk about some more incidents tomorrow, very similar to this one, in terms of wrestling with who God is and what he is. And I hope you'll come away from those lessons as convinced as I am of this one. God did the right thing. It was man who did the wrong thing. Follow God. Do the right thing. Because it is true, in the terms of all history of mankind, Jesus is coming soon. We need to be ready for him. And follow him, call him Lord. There's something we can do to help you come to the front right now while we stand.